Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Back in 1976, a group of architects offered a dramatic plan to expand Boston, a brand new neighborhood roughly the size of Beacon Hill that would provide new open space, parks, and housing for 45,000 people. But here's the kicker. It would all be built on platforms tethered to the bottom of Boston Harbor.
Planners wanted to use it first as a site for the 1976 World Expo. Then it would become a permanent, floating neighborhood and a bold vision and statement about Boston's future. The neighborhood, of course, was never built, and the 1976 World Expo never came to be.
But as Courtney Humphreys wrote recently in the Boston Globe, the idea for that floating island neighborhood came in an age when Boston still dared to dream big and offer sweeping visions of what the city's future might be.
So where's the sweeping plan for Boston's future today? And do we need one? A half century ago, the city was scarred by urban renewal, from the blight of the Central Artery Project to the tragic demolition of the West End neighborhood. But today, cities face big challenges, from gentrification to global warming, and some say they require big solutions and big plans.
So listeners, is it time for Boston to think big about its future again? And if so, what's the plan and what's needed? Is a floating neighborhood? If a floating neighborhood doesn't make sense, how about the urban ring linking the outskirts of metropolitan Boston? Or a new plan to link up the waterfront? Or maybe big, bold, centralized plans aren't necessary. Maybe they're even dangerous. Let us know what you think. Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And joining me in the studio is Mark Pasnick. He's a principal at Over Under Architecture and Design Firm. He's also co-director of Pink Comma Gallery. He helped organize a recent exhibit about that never-built floating island neighborhood. And welcome to Radio Boston, Mark Pasnick. Great to have you.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Jim Kostaris. He's a senior research fellow at the Institute for International Urban Development in Cambridge. For many years, he worked at the Boston Redevelopment Authority, where he was Assistant Director of Economic Development and Senior Architect. Welcome to you, Jim Kostaris. Great to have you.
Thank you, Anthony.
So, Mark, let me start with you, and I want to just get a brief question about this floating neighborhood. Let's start with that terrific story. This was an idea from Jan Wampier, who now teaches at MIT. How did that idea represent the thinking in Boston of that time? What was significant about it to you?
Well, it comes at the sort of at a reinvention point in urban renewal, where post West End demolition, the BRA and the Boston Redevelopment Authority and new figures like Ed Logue, who led it starting in 1960, had started to think of better strategies for changing things in the city, in particular working with communities, which wasn't a part of the process with the West End demolition. A few years later, the city created a very large master plan, which had was in 1965, looking at the next 10 years, and proposed as part of that creating what was called the World's Freedom Fair for the city. Jan Wampler was brought in the late 60s to start to study how to do that immediately after the World's Fair in Montreal. And so he started to create a vision that would be different from Montreal's strategy, one which would look at not only bringing people to Boston for a temporary bicentennial celebration, but also creating a larger neighborhood where the infrastructure, the federal investment of that time, could be used for a long-term improvement to the city. And I think this is what's innovative about the plan.
So it was a big, bold plan that was really put forth on a big scale. Why did we move away from that kind of big, bold plan?
Well, I think there's a lot of criticism of urban renewal, and much of it is rightly so, that certainly destruction of neighborhoods is not a good strategy for remaking cities. And in the 70s and into the 80s, I think we're also seeing political changes, less funding of cities, for instance. Federal funding starts to dry up. Cities are dealing with many other new types of issues. Communities are getting more of a voice in the process, and rightly so. In addition to that, I think cities are facing new challenges. And Politically, too, we're moving away from that kind of sense of central authority. Think back to the JFK era, and we believed in government, and move away to the Reagan era, and we see we don't as much. And I think that's been part of the shift away from centralized planning.
Now, Jim Costaris, I am going to come to you, so stand by for one more question here to Mark, because I just want him to lay out this one idea. You're a proponent, Mark, of returning to this sort of mid-century ambition. I know you're not saying raise neighborhoods and all that kind of bad stuff, but you think we've lost something by not embracing that big idea about the city's future, right?
I do. I think we've shifted away from a time when we trusted in central authority, which had expertise and knowledge that could be applied to vast problems. In the 60s, Boston was facing a time where it needed to reinvent itself entirely. Mm-hmm. It was essentially a backwater city at the time economically. It had to reinvent itself very quickly. Today, we face all sorts of new challenges. Half the globe's population lives in urban centers. And, of course, we have all sorts of climate issues coming forward in the future. And these kinds of things, I think, need some big thinking. And I don't think we as a society and we as a city are equipped for that.
Mm. So, Jim Costaris, let me come to you. You have a different view about all this. Concerns about relying on that big sort of centralized authority and big, bold sort of centralized plan for the city's future.
I do, Anthony. I should say that I know Mark Pasnick, and he and his colleagues at his firm Over Under, I happen to think are, you know, doing some of the most innovative work in Boston and overseas as well. But I'm going to respectfully disagree with Mark today. I think the
he seems okay with that, by the way.
Well, he hasn't heard what I said yet.
Wait until you hear what he says.
I think this idea of these bold, sweeping plans with a kind of a singular vision laid out for Boston or for other cities is largely overrated as an approach. They may be provocative, and that's a good thing, but in fact, I don't believe they're particularly useful for a number of reasons. First of all, there's simply no money or public commitment, financial commitment, to realize these bold plans. The other issue is, of course, that the public simply doesn't trust government very much, and they certainly don't trust other institutions. And they're not likely, and in fact haven't trusted, the idea of one or a group of people at the top laying out a grand vision. I think that...
But Jim, what do we have instead? So if we don't have like one or two people at the top laying out the grand vision, sort of where does the heart of Boston beat and how do we sort of plan the future?
Okay. Well, I think in fact what we have at its best is a collection of what I would call small but nevertheless bold visions in particular communities. I'll give you some examples in a second, but I think that what we need to do is embrace this patchwork of particular bottom-up visions and have a strategy to patch them all together in some kind of cohesive way. I'll give you some examples. About 15 years ago, the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative was launched by the residents of this community in Roxbury, a very low-income community at the time, that was frustrated by the presence of vacant land and absentee landlords. And the BRA, in fact, gave them the powers of eminent domain and helped them to realize a very compelling vision. In the South End, the Washington Street redevelopment that listeners might be familiar mm-hmm. with over the past 10 years, that part of the South End has really blossomed as a very exciting neighborhood.
And so could these sort of relatively small bore projects that have include the city in small areas, could they not coexist with a bigger plan? I mean, does it have to be, is it either or? Or would a bigger sort of centralized plan work against the kind of progress we've seen in the neighborhood?
I would say not a plan in, not a traditional comprehensive plan from the mid-century. I would characterize it as a strategy and a framework that articulates values and aspirations for the future. That could be a framework within which these smaller bore, but I want to emphasize equally bold visions, can emerge. And I think the urban planner's role, or one of them, is to really link together and leverage these small bore efforts, in a way that I'll use the expression that gets used all the time: the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. It's overused, but in fact I think that applies here, where the planner's job is to ensure that the sum of the parts, taken together in the aggregate, result in a greater whole.
Well, Mark Pasnik, let me bring you back in here. Give me a sense of the kind of big vision that you'd like to see for Boston. If not a floating neighborhood in Boston Harbor, what would it be?
Well, I think, so for me, the vision is not that I have a singular vision, nor that I think there is somebody like Haussmann in Paris who's remaking the entire city in bold strokes. But I think we haven't given enough license to our own agency, to the BRA, to the city itself, to lead us in bigger initiatives for the city and looking at more comprehensive planning. So for me, it's not a question of bringing in some genius designer that would come in and save us all. In fact, it is still a public process, but it's one where at present, my argument is that at present, really, the city is shaped mostly by development pressures and community pressures battling with one another. And the third leg of that, which is the city, is acting perhaps as a gatekeeper on those projects, but isn't really thinking further. And I don't think that's actually the BRA's fault. I think it's the fault of many American cities where the public isn't demanding that. And we're going to face huge challenges coming forward that need us to be thinking 50 years in advance, even if those challenges aren't all resolved in the plan. For instance, I just wanted to go back to the 1965 plan.
Sure.
There's still several parts of that plan which are being enacted now, areas of the city which had been predicted in 1965 as future growth, which we're now seeing growth occurring in. And of course, there are some of these kinds of projects in the city of Boston. The air rights, for instance, has been one that's been on tap for a very long time. The central artery, of course, with the big dig, is another example of larger scale planning. But for me, I think there needs to be more involvement of the city and more direction from the city thinking this way for the future. You see it in many other cities across the globe.
Well, let me hold that thought, because I actually want to come back and ask you about sort of where these big ideas are being hatched and guiding cities elsewhere. That might present an example that for Boston to follow. But first, I want to encourage our listeners to get back into this conversation. Listeners, let us know what you think. Is it time for Boston to think big about its future again? And if so, what's your plan? What's needed? Or is big, bold, centralized planning unnecessary, maybe even dangerous, as Jim Costaris is suggesting? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Mark, let me just get you to respond to Mark's sort of advocacy for, these small focused neighborhood initiatives as really being the way to go. And I guess, one of the reasons I would ask that question is we saw some of these big urban renewal projects just clobber neighborhoods. And this happened all across the country. It's not just Boston's West End and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. In other words, are they necessarily incompatible with each other, the big plan and more parochial neighborhood interests?
No, and I think one of the lessons of urban renewal, or at least of early urban renewal, is not to abandon communities, not to make them outsiders in the process, that in fact they need to be involved in the process in every way. I think that the pendulum has swung away from any central authority, and I think that for me is the question of where we should go in the future, that we should balance that community force, which is good for the city, with a kind of professional force, which is part of the process. And I mentioned other cities. I think places like Amsterdam or Toronto have much more vibrant planning going on, very large-scale projects that are happening in areas adjacent to the city that I think are much more sophisticated than the work that we're doing, for instance, in the South Boston waterfront.
Mm. Jim, you worked at the BRA from 1985 to 2003 for the Boston Redevelopment
Authority.
That's
correct, Anthony.
Mark's talking about giving the BRA sort of more clout, more power to kind of articulate
and funding.
And more funding to implement a big sort of vision. What's your response to that? How do you see that?
Well, there's a few things you need to understand about the BRA. The BRA was created in 1965 or thereabouts.
I think 57.
But 65,
but
it really
65
came
is
into
when
its own.
It was actually funded with federal dollars. And Boston was a dying city. The BRA had a leading role in saving and rescuing Boston. What's important to understand about the BRA is that it's, in fact, it's, I would describe it as a public sector real estate development and asset management organization. Hmm. Planning is a function, but in fact, it was set up to create the conditions for investment in the city, which was critical in the 60s. And it has a formidable array of powers already, the powers of eminent domain. The BRA owns land. It's an actor in the real estate market. And by and large, it has successfully leveraged, you know, the land that it has owned to make important developments happen. And we could go into them if we had time, but... I think one of the problems is that, the criticism is that it doesn't do planning. The fact is traditional comprehensive planning has never been the mission of the BRA. This has been over the years and continues today to have very talented professionals. But my criticism... I guess my only criticism is that in recent years it has tended to react to real estate developers and done what I would call just-in-time planning to stay one step ahead of real estate development.
Well, let me jump in. I don't want to get too bogged down in sort of BRA issues, but I do want to sort of get you to respond to Mark's point about, you know, the big issues of today. For example, I mean, I'll throw out a couple. The city is increasingly... less diverse. There's a shortage of affordable housing.
Sure.
Struggling with gentrification. Big challenges related to climate change that would certainly affect a port city. Aren't these struggles, challenges, that sort of demand a big sweeping vision? And sweeping
they
idea?
Are. They are. And I actually agree with Mark on this point. I think these big, bold plans are embraced by society, mm-hmm. Certainly in the United States, in times of crisis and threat. We could see a whole change and embrace in this kind of more centralized planning when you think of the threat of climate change, rising sea levels. Mm-hmm. An interesting story, in the 1980s, the Boston Society of Architects sponsored a ideas competition and invited teams to propose visions for the city. One of the winning entries was submitted by... some prominent local urban designers, Antonio de Mambro, Margarita Iglesia, and others. And they proposed a series of islands that would dam and protect, that would connect the Boston Harbor outer islands and protect the inner harbor from rising sea level change. And this is before the term global warming was even being
read. So there's a big idea.
There's a big idea. And I could see a time when... if rising sea levels become especially dramatic, where there's an embrace for this kind of big, bold, sweeping idea.
But we're just not dealing with that kind of crisis right now. Is the thinking here?
We're not yet.
Let me just get a couple of callers into this conversation because I don't want our time to run out without getting them. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you today? Hi, Jim. Hi. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
I'm familiar with the Boston architecture and planning scene. Jim, you may recall my work on the South Bay Harbor Trail effort.
I do. How are you, Michael?
I'm good. I was encouraged to hear you recall Antonio DeMombro's and his team's scheme for the building a great big dike connecting Long Island and Deer Island to keep out the rising waters due to global warming, if that in fact becomes the case. I wanted to suggest that what makes a city really dynamic and exciting is when you have small bore initiatives like the Harbor Trail or like the various efforts made along Washington Street in the South End, right? Those were small, accrued improvements that have made Boston a much better place to live. But I think those should be balanced with very broad initiatives and continue the tradition of planning like the Back Bay that took place, in the 1800s. And, the Central Artery was more of an engineering feat, but, of course, there was a lot of process involved there.
Michael, let me just pick up this idea of balancing small-bore initiatives with a bigger sort of generating and guiding principle. Mark Pasnick, does that make sense to you?
I think absolutely. And, Anthony, I would say that Michael's right on that. I wanted to come back to a point that you made about the diversity of the city. The urban core of Boston is very undiverse. It lacks diversity, and that's
socioeconomic diversity?
And in particular, one of the interesting ironies of urban renewal, which most people decry, is that it is one of the few instances where we do have diversity in the city. So a neighborhood like the South End, which manages to be quite diverse, is diverse precisely because of centralized planning, because of things like the housing projects that went in, including some like Villa Victoria, which had a robust community process as part of them. So that central authority combined with community efforts made for a much more diverse center city.
Let's try to get another call in. Rodney from Jamaica Plain. Rodney, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Very well. What's on your mind?
I think this is a great conversation. I wanted to continue, obviously, past today. I just want to champion the idea of doing smaller-scale neighborhood-based master planning. I had the pleasure of working as a senior project manager at the Boston Redevelopment Authority overseeing the Jackson Square Master Plan, which was about a 15-year community process, which culminated in about 400 units of housing, 70,000 square feet of commercial space in the Jamaica Plain area. I think as we move away from the sort of urban renewal days of the 60s, we're going to find that it's a better approach to understanding a community and capitalizing on the assets of the community by doing these neighborhood-based master plans.
Okay, Rodney, I'm going to let you go with that thought. Jim, he seems to be speaking your language, and our time is just about to run out. So let me just give you like the final 10 seconds here to sort of wrap it up for us.
Okay, I want to emphasize that, doing small bore bottom-up plans is no less visionary and, in fact, can be equally bold as these centralized, old-fashioned, sweeping, comprehensive plans that cities produced in the middle of the 19th century and beyond.
That's Jim Kastaris. He's a senior research fellow at the Institute for International Urban Development in Cambridge. Thanks for coming in. We appreciate it, Jim. And Mark Pasnick, principal at Over Under Architecture Design Firm in the South End. He's also co-director of Pink Comma Gallery. Mark Pasnick, many thanks for coming in and thanks for bringing this idea to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And listeners, thank you for your ideas and comments. The conversation about Boston and big ideas continues on Facebook and at RadioBoston.org. Still ahead, our weekly Common Health segment. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.